This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
The first annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival will take place Wednesday, August 7th and Saturday, August 10th at Park Rose High School Performing Arts Center, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland. Jim Pepper was born in Salem, Oregon and lived in the Portland area for many years. A jazz saxophone composer and singer of Native American ancestry, he became a pioneer of fusion jazz in the late 1960s. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio and the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11 o'clock. Up next on Health and Healthcare Forum, host Roberta Hall speaks with Jim Gavea and Amy Thompson of Oregon State University's Counseling and Psychological Services. The theme is mental health for college students. At 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Ren Green speaks with Peter Clark of the upcoming What the Festival about the music, art, performance workshops, and film screenings at the festival. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. My guests today are Jim Gavea and Amy Thompson, and they're with the OSU Counseling Center. Amy just finished a degree, and she's worked here as a graduate assistant, but now she's working for real, doing the same work, I'll bet. And Jim's been a counselor here for quite a long time, I think. True?
About 3 years.
About 3 years. Mm-hmm. Oh. Were you in counseling before that, before you came here?
Oh, yeah. I've been in the field for 24 years.
But, I thought so.
Yeah, but just at OSU for the last 3 years. Right. Prior to that, I was in private practice here in town in Corvallis.
And counseling is a fairly broad term. And I think of counseling as being counseling for academic choices. We're here at an academic institution. And so that's a big part of student decision-making and so forth. And I know there's a counseling center elsewhere.
We have academic advisors that do some counseling around academics, what courses to take. We have career counseling that help with career choices. And then we have Academic Success Center that works around study skills and study habits. So there are different avenues. We're a mental health facility, so we're a mental health clinic. We work with people who are coming in with depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, possibly some abuse history or current abuse issues. So all of those things.
All of those things. And one of the questions I had for you, this is as a layperson, of course, how do you know that a person's counseling is sort of, let's say, simple depression or incident-caused depression versus a more severe mental illness such as bipolar? How is that possible to determine?
Well, we always do a clinical assessment when people come in. We do an intake. We use the DSM-3, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual that all clinicians use to sort of determine what are the symptoms that we see, how do those symptoms match with the diagnosis, and then being able to diagnose whatever the issue is in the moment. So sometimes it takes more than one meeting or even several meetings to come up with that diagnosis because cases can be complicated, they can be confusing. People are confusing. I'm confusing. So we try to be pretty thorough and before we give a diagnosis because that's kind of a serious thing to give somebody. So.
It really is, and then the treatment that's provided would definitely depend on the diagnosis.
Right. you want to do what's best practice, what's the most effective for someone, depending on their diagnosis and whether we're going to refer them for medication or what kind of interventions we're going to do or what we're going to try to accomplish in it. And hopefully we do that with the student. They're coming up with their own treatment plan, their goal, what they're hoping to obtain, what's getting in their way of being successful.
And do you sometimes then refer them to other clinicians if you need a second opinion or...
Yes, if it wasn't my expertise, I would say another clinician has expertise in eating disorder. Mm-hmm. That person would be better served there, and I would refer them over to that person with that expertise.
How many counselors do you have here?
I think we have 18. But there's 29,000 students. That's not a lot when you look at how many students there are.
Are they all counselors? Is that their background?
We have a mixture of psychologists, licensed clinicians. All of us are licensed. So we have psychologists, we have licensed marriage and family therapists, and then licensed clinical social worker, which I am.
Okay. So that way, if you have an appointment with someone and you really think that someone you know on your staff could handle it better, you could refer it.
Absolutely.
It would work like that. And don't doctoral students in clinical psychology sometimes help out with seeing students?
We have 4 interns, and we also have practicum students, so people in their master's program who also work here. So we have 4 interns and 4 prac students here during the academic year. So, yes, and they provide services first time. Individually, in groups, couples counseling, so...
The clients are all students, is that correct?
Yes, you have to be a student in order to get services here. We're funded by student fees, so you have to have paid your student fees.
So if a staff person or a faculty, well, they have to go outside?
Absolutely, they have insurance, so they have to go where their insurance sends them, yes.
Insurance always sets the rules these days, doesn't it?
But we do work with graduate students, so master levels and PhD level students who are here as well, so...
And that gets to the 29,000.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Amy, tell us about your role, and then we'll talk about some more specific issues that come up.
Sure. One of the things we do at CAPS, at the Counseling Center here, is consider outreach initiatives and mental health promotion initiatives. So we're currently looking at how we do that. So part of my work is trying to lead a campus mental health initiative that views the entire campus as partners in providing mental health support for our students and seeing how we can create an environment here on campus that is supportive of mental health of our students. So that, yes, the counseling center is here and it serves the clinical needs of our students, but what are the ways in which our academic partners might play a role in being partners in supporting mental health for our students, and what are the ways that the environment supports remaining mentally healthy?
And by supports, would that be in terms of making suggestions or referrals to the students directly? Maybe you would get help if you went to the counseling center or something like that?
Certainly we want that. So we want to raise the profile of the clinical services, but this is beyond that. This is looking at what are the ways that we can provide educational experiences and a campus culture that actually is one that supports health. We're pretty early in our initiative right now, but right now we're looking at this idea of flourishing. And so what we'd like to do is sort of bring this idea to the community and say, what are you doing in the area that you work in that helps promote student flourishing? So whether that be, are there ways we can deliver academic content that builds upon the strengths of the students in the classroom? So what strengths are they bringing and how can we use those to enhance their experience in the classroom?
So that would be all students.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's kind of part of this initiative, is that it's not just students that are diagnosable or that are suffering from a mental illness, but we want to actually reach everyone on campus. And how can you be mentally healthier? So you might not have, you might not feel depressed, you might not have anxiety, but are you living up to your full potential?
So we're looking at some current research that's been done around flourishing that really shows that there are certain aspects of people's choices that they make around their life that can help them flourish more. So you can have a mental illness and be flourishing,
right. Mm-hmm.
But you can have mental health and be languishing. And so we're really saying, how do you find flourishing in your life? How do you find volunteerism? How do you find your passion? How do you engage in the campus community? How do you engage in academics? It's a really, as Amy was saying, a comprehensive way of looking at all students and how do we create a new culture that says we want you to flourish. How do we give you the opportunities, but then how do you take the opportunities and run?
So, just to put it simply, it's a way or it's an attitude toward making people comfortable and finding a role that really suits them, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Absolutely.
And not just here, but in society, beyond OSU, in their community, wherever that may be, if they stay here in Corvallis or if they go off to another state or another country.
That's a big order. That's a,
yeah.
a move
out of the person on the couch in the, in the conversation, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about this age group that makes them particularly susceptible? That's an interesting part of it, I think, because developmentally, people are changing, and sometimes I understand that some mental illnesses show up in the late teens, early 20s, and so forth. And how do you deal with that? Do you see that very much?
Well, you're looking at, for a traditional student, 18 to 24 years old, from the time they come in, they're can be 17, but normally 18 by the time they graduate, around 22, 24, depending on how long it takes them to get through school. And in that age group, this is a time when, if there is a major mental illness, this could be the time that it shows up, whether it be schizophrenia, psychosis, or even bipolar or depression. It can often show up here. But beyond that minority, which is a small minority of folks, there is a larger, and Amy can talk to this a bit as well, is that developmental struggles of who am I, separate from my parents, who am I in society, what is my role going to be, what do I want to do with my life? So it's a pretty crucial point of determining where their passion lies. It's determining where they fit. And so that can be really fun and exciting, but it can also be confusing and scary for some folks. So it's really, I think, fun to work with, and also at the same time can be challenging in regards to, especially in this day and age, of creating options or having students see their options.
So many options.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And changing options from the ones they may have learned about when they were at home, wherever it might be, whether it's Eastern Oregon or somewhere around the world.
Yeah.
Right, and you're dealing with a population, you know, when you're coming to college, you're in constant transition. So you have all the developmental issues that are happening naturally when you're 18 to 24, but then you put it in a college environment and you're dealing with home, you know, leaving home, transitioning, social transitions, having a new friend group, peer groups, the academic pressure to succeed. So there's so many different forces that are additional stressors in that mm-hmm. environment.
And that might relate somewhat to the flourishing.
Absolutely. So how do we prepare our students? You know, how well prepared are they with the tools that they bring to campus to mm-hmm. handle those things? And what can we provide to help them build new tools to navigate transitions?
And I noticed out in your waiting room there are some little flyers about suicide prevention and issues like that and Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it looked to me like the Alcoholic Anonymous groups met at various places around town, but not on campus.
Well, we have one treatment group that I run here, Smart Recovery Group, that we run during the school year. And then we have one AA meeting that works that meets on campus. The brochure that you saw is an AA document talking about all 12-step meetings that happen across Corvallis, mm-hmm. across Benton County, actually. So, yes, alcohol and drugs is a big issue for this age group, but it can become an issue where it becomes not out of recreational use anymore, it becomes abuse, and then eventually it can become a dependent issue. And so we work with students to help them make good decisions around their alcohol use. We are not the prevention part of things, we're really the intervention part of things. Prevention is another department, health promotions over at Student Health Services.
Well, I wondered how that worked with Student Health Services, because I remember that they've done some work in prevention over there.
Yeah, so if someone's violated for an alcohol violation, they'll go see Rob Reff, who runs the IMPACT program, and they'll go through IMPACT. But if they decide, I really want to make a change in my life, they probably end up here seeing me, and then we would work from there, or someone in the community. Suicide prevention. We have an Active Minds chapter here on campus. Active Minds is a student organization that's a national organization. There's over 350 across the country and in Canada. And what they do is they work to promote mental health and to destigmatize mental illnesses on college campuses. So we have a core group of around 15 students who do activities throughout the year around suicide prevention, mental health promotion, and destigmatizing mental illness. But we also have a campus coalition that's working around suicide prevention, looking at best practice, looking at high-risk groups, and trying to intervene where our resources will allow us.
And the Active Minds, I was reading about it on the web. It started about 10 years ago, as I understand, and it had its origins a few years before, and there was a different name. I can't remember what it was now, but it incorporated as Active Minds around 10 years ago and really has taken off. Now, who are the students that make it up? Do they have a particular interest in studying psychology or counseling, or are they individuals who themselves have experienced one of the mental illness problems, or maybe somebody in their family that has kind of clued them into, well, we better do something, or...
Yes and yes.
Yes and yes.
There are psychology majors. It's really good experience for them, especially if they're going into psychology or into counseling. So they join and they're active. Looks good on your resume. There are people who have their own experience with mental health issues or mental illness. They join because they're thriving in school and they want to let other people know that it's possible. And then there are other people who have experienced that in their own family, family members and so forth. And so many of them, their goal is to destigmatize that mental illness. There is a movie star who is currently promoting mental health, Glenn Close. Yes, and her family members. She has a nephew and a sister who has mental illness. And I think she's doing the same thing around destigmatizing the mental illness. And so Active Minds, that's who encompasses it right now.
Like some of the work that NAMI does, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, a large organization with chapters all around the country and active chapters here. And some of them are family members of mentally ill patients. Some of them have had mental illness, and it's mainly peers, as I understand it, rather than professionals. And Active Minds, I guess, is sort of the same concept, and it's more peers than the professionals. Do they have a support system from the staff?
Well, I'm the faculty advisor, so I work pretty closely with them. Amy's joining us to incorporate more into the mental health initiative, have Active Minds be more of a part of that, so she's going to really be the link between the larger campus mental health initiatives and Active Minds. But you're right on when you talk about this peer education model, and I think that's what Active Minds is about, is a peer education model, that we know that students may listen to their peers more than they're going to listen to some adult saying, you know, that mental illness is okay and mental health is good and let's work towards those things. This peer education model is really what we're working on, peers talking to peers. I think it's been really effective. We've had some great success, brought some amazing speakers to campus. We have a daisy project every year where we put out 1,100 daisies, which represents the amount of students who have died from suicide every year in the United States. 1,100. And this year we had 4 yellow daisies to represent the 4 students that died here at OSU from suicide in 1 year. So they've done some really amazing things, as well as some fun things like putting up positive affirmations on little sticky notes all over campus, just sort of saying, you're good enough, you're beautiful, kinds of statements just all over the place. So I think it's been a positive addition for sure. Mm-hmm. This is our 5th year, I believe, that we've had an Active Minds chapter here.
This reminded me of the issue of bullying. Now, we see a lot of that in grade school, junior high, and high school, but by the time people are in the university, is bullying pretty much gone, or is it still with us as a problem that really would increase the stigma rather than work against it?
I'm going to let Amy answer that.
Certainly no, it still exists, and I think especially with so many of our students spending a lot of their times online, there's a lot of incidents that occur online in social networking communities that can certainly appear to be bullying. But I know OSU just recently instituted an anti-bullying policy, so it's on our radar, and that policy came from the president,
yes.
I believe, the president's office.
Yep.
I don't know actually too much about it.
Well, you also got to remember, we're going to have all freshmen required to live on campus. So you're going to have, I don't know how many freshmen we're going to have, 5,000, all living together in very small spaces with people they don't really know. So cliques happen. Those things don't go away very quickly. So whether it's microaggressions or just straight out macroaggressions, it still happens. Humans are humans. And so we're really trying to create safety and a place for all students to be able to feel comfortable and safe. And I think that was part of the initiative out of the president's office.
This reminds me of an incident when I was a freshman and there were 30 freshmen in the dorm. And one, unfortunately, she happened to live right next door to me, got into the habit of stealing things from everybody else. I was in the generation that experienced a lot of polio. We had 3 out of the 30 who'd experienced polio. She had it the least and was the most unhealthy from it, you might say, because when things weren't going well, she limped a great deal. When they were going well, she didn't. And she began just stealing things. First it was postage stamps, then it was cookies that people received from their families, and then it got to be umbrellas. She must have had 30 umbrellas.
Oh my gosh.
It was very weird, and the reason I mention it is that most of us who knew her tried to avoid her when they found out about it, but we didn't report her. And I realized later, when it was reported, and of course she left, we should have. We really should have. It would have been better for her and certainly for all of us, because it was a very upsetting incident. And, you know, what became of her? She lived in Pennsylvania and this was in North Carolina. I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, sometimes getting the help that people need is more important than the friendships or having people be mad at you. And sometimes we go on the side of safety, hoping that people won't be mad at us, so we don't say anything, versus this person needs help. They're not very happy. Maybe we can get them some help. So
we looked at her more as a bully than as a sick person, I think. And she always knew when I had to study on something, that would be when she would come over and talk and talk and talk, and you just want to get rid of her. How she always knew that, but she had that bullying way that some bullies do. They know how to get your goat. You know, we were all 18 or 19. We should have done something. We should have talked to each other, and ultimately some of us apparently did, because it was resolved and we all felt the better for it.
Well, I think that's an interesting thing about that age group, especially the 18 to 20-year-olds. You're an adult. That's what you're claimed to be, but you're not quite there yet, though you think you should be, and there are certain expectations around that. And I just think it's a rough age. You're sort of in between this adult, child, or at least adolescent stage. So it's tough to know what's the right thing to do. And you're just still in the phase of trying to figure out yourself, not everybody else.
That's a nice excuse for me, but I won't buy it.
That was just my own experience of being 18.
And you're right. We can't, at our own age, go back and wish we'd been different, because we weren't different.
Right, exactly, exactly.
So sometimes it's nice having an adult around. Well, Amy, what is your plan? What are you going to be doing? You're going to be working here through the school year. You found a career through studying for a career.
I'm in College Student Services Administration, which I guess, you know, is mostly known as student affairs. So it's the non-classroom, non-academic piece of College Student Services. So the work I'll be doing here at the Counseling Center is supervising our student staff, because we do have actually students on staff. So we have undergraduates and graduate students that do some mostly outreach work for us, some of our marketing work for us, and office tasks. So I'll be supervising the student staff and really trying to co-lead this mental health initiative, which just kind of started taking flight last year. So it's not quite, you know, it hasn't fully come into fruition yet. So continuing to build those relationships across campus. Really, it's the work we're doing is pretty innovative. I hope we end up with a national profile because of the work we're doing. We're really approaching mental health promotion in a different way than it's been done in the past in counseling centers. Where usually a traditional outreach in counseling centers, a faculty member might call up and say, I'd like you to do a workshop in my class, and they're usually these one-shot deals, or you know, you're tabling at an event saying, here's the counseling center, we're here, but really trying to revision how we can create a campus-wide awareness and participation in supporting and promoting mental health and what that can look like.
Well, the people I talked to in NAMI said that stigma was really the most pressing problem that presents itself to mentally ill people.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, it was said that if it's a psychosis or bipolar, something like that, as opposed to maybe a depression that isn't as, that's kind of masked, or you don't always see it in an individual. Well, there's another topic I'd like to mention. You know, I was referred to you by the Director of Diversity Development, Victoria Huynh, and she said that many of the students that she works with, and these are maybe they're American Indian students, maybe they're African American, and then, of course, the other centers are the Latino Center for a large population that we do have here on campus, and also people from the Pacific Islands. So how do you reach out to these groups? She said that there are sometimes concerns because the students come away from a home environment, a culture that's more enclosed and more representing the families, and then they come to campus, which is multicultural to say the least, and very diverse, and people from all over the world. Do you ever experience the situation I'm talking about?
Well, I think when you talk about stigma, there is also cultural stigmas around accessing mental health services for some cultures where it's, you know, it's within the family. If you have an issue, you deal with it within the family. You don't go to outside sources. You don't share your business with other folks. So we have liaisons with cultural centers. Most of the cultural centers have a liaison with the counseling center who work to break down some of those barriers for access. So, yeah, I think we try to look at the cultural history people bring to counseling, and then we try to work with that when they come. So stigma is a huge thing. We just had a training with the military around accessing services within the military, and there's still the stigma in the military. If you say, I'm depressed and I need to see a counselor, you may not be able to rise up in the ranks. You may say, that's it. So how do you access services when there's the consequences of now you're going to be labeled as having this issue? Versus we all have mental health and that we all have things that we deal with. It's actually, to me, a sign of health to say, I'm not doing well, I need help to get through this, is healthier than stick with it and do it on your own. Because your thoughts are going to, they're going to get in your way. They do with all of us. It's just a human thing. Yeah.
We live in our heads
exactly.
As much as on the ground.
Yeah, and those thoughts are not facts. We just keep on thinking they are and then acting that way. So, we work very closely with the cultural centers and we really try to be very sensitive to that. We have a Latina psychologist who speaks Spanish. We have a Middle Eastern psychologist who speaks Arabic. We have LGBT therapists here. I think we really do try to make it. We have a Japanese psychologist who speaks Japanese. So I think we've really made an effort to diversify who's providing services and access for people from diverse backgrounds.
If a person calls up and sets an appointment, is it kind of random who they are actually meeting with? But then after that, that counselor can determine maybe the next step.
Absolutely. So if someone says, I want a Spanish-speaking counselor, they might give them the Spanish-speaking counselor right off. But if they come in and I do the intake and they say, really, I want to talk to someone who speaks Spanish, then I would just refer them after that first initial intake appointment.
So having a relatively large staff, even if it's small compared to the total student body, is useful.
Yes, it's helpful to have a diverse staff that have different expertise and different understandings. It just makes it a much better place to meet people's needs.
The other thing I could ask is, do you work with people outside campus?
We refer to other therapists all the time. We absolutely, if someone has insurance and they'd be better, their needs would be better met in the community, then we refer them out. We try to make the link.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me and with KBOO. Amy Thompson and Jim Govia.
And thank you, Bobby, for asking us. That was nice. Thanks.
The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall. and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording in Corvallis, Oregon. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers in Kent White.
As the planet lurches past 400 parts per million concentration of CO2, the moment has come for all of us to do hard, important, powerful things to combat climate change. The last 2 weeks of July are, statistically, the hottest stretch of the year. As part of the nationally coordinated summer heat action, Bill McKibben, author and co-founder of 350.org, will speak this Wednesday, July 17th, in Vancouver, Washington, to talk about climate change and the movement to turn it around. KABU will broadcast his talk live.
Either Exxon has to give in or physics has to give in. It'll be hard to change Exxon's mind. I think it'll be harder to get physics to compromise.
That's Bill McKibben of 350.org. Tune in Wednesday, July 17th at 7:30 p.m. to hear a live broadcast of Bill McKibben speaking at Clark College in Vancouver.
This is Ren Green. I'm here with Peter Clark, the general manager of What the Festival, and we're here to talk about his upcoming event. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you so much, Ren. It's wonderful to be here.
So tell us, what is What the Festival?
So What the Festival is a music and arts experience-oriented festival. We create a very immersive environment for our attendees to experience. We build many different micro-experiences and feature four stages of music that range from small gypsy LOL stage up to our big main stage performing artists.
And when and where is What the Festival this year?
What the Festival is July 26th, 27th, and 28th, and 29th this year, 2013. And it's located just outside the town of Duffer in eastern Oregon.
How far a drive is that from here?
It's about 2 hours from Portland.
That is close. That is very close for what you're getting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've got some big names in your lineup, and I noticed Opulent Temple is participating. They are a Burning Man thing. To what extent are you like Burning Man?
Opulent Temple is kind of an interesting test for us this year to kind of experiment with a stage that's curated